We and one of Fred's goat herds took to eating wood rat houses instead of blackbrush and became a herd of, well, super-performing goats. It gave him reason to pause and ask questions like, can the nutrient wisdom of animals be used to better manage the environment?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 651st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Paphos who are tuned in as we stream along the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hi there.
Folks, when Fred Provenza was a graduate student in wildland resources, he employed 6 herds of goats to prune blackbrush in the wildlands of Utah. The idea was that more new life would spring forth from the pruned bushes and provide more feed for the domestic and wild animals grazing the lands. Fred noticed that one of his herds was outperforming his other herds and so started watching the herd closely to see if he could detect if they were doing something different, the animals. And lo and behold, he discovered that his herd of super goats had taken to dining on the protein-rich houses of wood rats. This observation led Fred to ask some very interesting questions. Do animals have an inherent knowledge about the nutrient requirements of their bodies? And what does this wisdom tell us about how we should feed our animals, and even ourselves, I guess? And finally, can the inherent nutrient wisdom of animals be used to better manage the environment? Incredible questions to ask from watching a few goats. So here to help us explore these questions, we have Fred Provenza himself. He's a PhD from the Department of Wildland Resources, University of Utah, but you're in Colorado, right, Fred?
Yes, Michael.
At your papa's house?
Yeah, at papa's house. We're building our own house in the backcountry of Colorado and dropped in here to try to visit with you folks.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we appreciate having you aboard today. Tell us a little bit about how you went from ranch hand to academic. That's an interesting progression.
Well, the ranch hand part started where I am right now in south central Colorado, a little town called Salida. And I didn't grow up on a ranch in this town, but I started hauling hay on that ranch when I was a senior in high school, and then ended up working there over a 7-year period. And so that got me really interested in animals and animal behavior. I was also going to Colorado State University at that time in wildlife biology program, and that, you know, the mix of soils and plants and animals and stuff, just all of that really got me interested in those sort of relationships.
Well, let me ask you a very, very important question. What do you learn by working on a farm or a ranch that you don't learn by going to school?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the things that leaps to mind is just the value of really hard work. In those days, we didn't have so much machinery. There was machinery, of course, but I'm showing my age now too, some. But you know, the hauling hay was all done by hand in those days. And you know, even when I was working there, I ended up managing the place for a 2-year period. But prior to that, I'd work summers and stuff, and it was 6 days a week, 10-hour days, and so just the value of really hard work was one thing that struck me, how hugely important that is, that ability to just do hard physical work. Another thing that struck me, too, though, was the person that I worked with was born in 1900. He died in 1986. His name was Henry DeLuca. But I came to appreciate that there's different kinds of knowledge. And the kind that Henry had, he never went to school in those days. He just wasn't able to do that. But his knowledge came to his brain through his hands and from just being out every day. And I learned a tremendous amount from just visiting with Henry and time spent with Henry. So those are two things, Michael, that really strike me were really really important learning experiences.
I guess from my background, I would have to agree with you 100% on both of them. The value of hard work and the wisdom of people who live on the land and work with their hands and their minds is just something truly exceptional.
Let me add just one other thought to that, too. I think, and of course, I've spent my career in science and working in that, and I really appreciate that. But I think we don't want to, as a society, discount this other kind of knowledge. And I think sometimes that can happen when we think, you know, everything has to be science-based and so forth.
Yeah. And one of the great tragedies, I think, is by taking all of our children off the land, they really have no place to learn those other skills that you just talked about. And so they hang around on street corners and are kind of, live in a different world, I guess. Let's go to your studies as a grad student and working with goats and with blackbrush. We city people know what goats are because we've seen pictures of them, but we don't know what blackbrush is. What is it?
You know, my wife and I just, I'm going to digress just a second. My wife and I just been on the road a lot. I was in Iowa 3 weeks ago for a week, and then my wife picked me up in the airport, and we drove to California, and we spent 10 days in your wonderful state. I was amazed at just how incredible that state is. But
yeah,
we drove through the blackbrush country, and where blackbrush occurs is in the transition zone between what people refer to as the cold deserts to the north and the hot deserts to the south. And so, you know, down in the southern Utah, northern Arizona, there's a little bit of blackbrush gets into California as well. We were able to see some. It would be a little bit north of the Mojave Desert, but it's in that transition zone between what people refer to as the cold and hot deserts.
Right, and it is sagebrush, right?
Well, it's not sagebrush, Michael. It's a different species from.
Oops. Ding.
Make a call, press 1.
It sounds like we were having a tough time there.
Press 2.
So we're going to go back and pick them up and
press 3. For
and
Golden
see
Retriever,
if we can't.
Press 4.
Carol's working the phones and she'll bring them right back. So I think what we'll do is take our first break and come back and we'll have Fred on the phones and go from there. Folks, this is the Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. We had a little bit of phone difficulties, but we'll pick it up and bring Fred right back. We're talking about a real interesting discovery he made while working with goats and using them to prune blackbrush shrubs in the deserts of Utah, and a discovery he made that really is changing the way America is thinking about managing its wildlands. Incredibly fascinating. I hope you'll pull up a chair and grab yourself a cup of coffee and join us, because we will be right back after these important messages. So please do stay tuned. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, we're back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Fred Provenza, Doctor of Wildland Resources, University of Utah. We're talking a little bit about his work and his discoveries in working with goats and blackbrush shrubs. Fred, we were talking a little bit about how blackbrush is not sagebrush, different species out there, and you were using the goats to prune the blackbrush shrubs, but why?
Well, the idea, Michael, was that, and this was, keep in mind, this was over 30 years ago, and so I think it was a little bit ahead of the curve on this, but the idea was to use a domestic animal as opposed to mechanical kinds of ways that you could shred the plant, just simply use a biological approach to rejuvenate the shrub. It doesn't, blackbrush doesn't grow much during the spring and summer unless it's pruned. And so if you prune the shrub back during the winter time, then that stimulates growth during the spring and summer. And the idea was to try to use the goats then to enhance the amount of new growth that was on the plant so it would be available for cattle who utilize those landscapes as well as for mule deer, bighorn sheep. So we're thinking about wild domestic animals both and simply using the goats as a tool to accomplish that land rejuvenation.
Make more food for everybody, right?
Yeah, make more food that was more nutritious for other animals. We knew that the new growth was higher in energy and protein, minerals like phosphorus, than the old woody growth. And so we figured we'd create better habitat then for all kinds of creatures.
So you're mowing through the landscape with your goats, but you saw that one herd of goats, they're called herds, aren't they?
Yeah, we had little flocks, we called them. Yeah.
Little flocks? Okay, one of your flocks it turned out to be more effective than other flocks. And why was that?
Well, as you'd mentioned earlier, what we noticed was that one of the flocks was eating these wood rat houses that are at the base of the juniper trees that are common throughout that landscape. And it was amazing to see that, actually. But then when we were weighing the goats at regular intervals, it was clear that small group was doing better than the five other groups out there. And then, you know, come to find out, when we looked carefully at the wood rat houses, there are places in those houses that are just very densely packed vegetation, and it's soaked in urine. And so what it was a protein supplement that was really helping those goats out during the winter time.
So from this observation, you came up with a great heresy.
Well, we really did, because back in those days, Michael, the general feeling in the science community was that domestic animals didn't have nutritional wisdom. There was some thought
Wait a minute. Now, when I mentioned this to my producer, Carol Stafford, she said, oh, come on. What kind of academic could possibly believe that? But it was true, wasn't it?
Well, it was true, and you have to trace back historically why that happened. There were some studies that were done here in the U.S. as well as in other countries back in the 50s and 60s where people would offer animals cafeteria choices of minerals or vitamins that they supposedly needed. And the animals didn't select in the kinds and proportions that people thought that they should based upon our knowledge at the time. And so I think people were fairly open to the idea of nutritional wisdom until those studies were done, and then it made people really skeptical. They thought, well, we don't see them selecting the minerals and vitamins that we think they need in the proportions that we think they need. And so it was a really natural evolution.
So the animals are dumb? They're not doing what we think they should do, so therefore they don't know what they're doing, so therefore we're going to mix food to the proportions that we think they need them, right?
Yes, that's where the whole, that's a nice summary of where everything went then, and that was really a kind of a branching point at that point, where if they'd have found that animals really just honed right in the ways that we thought, I think the way that we feed animals nowadays would be quite different. We wouldn't rely so much on premixed feeds and total mixed rations and those sort of things. But, you know, when those studies didn't find much evidence for nutritional wisdom of the body, then people thought, well, we need to mix everything for them. You know, our blackbrush work at first didn't support those ideas either, and I remember visiting with a good friend who was a toxicologist/nutritionist on campus.
That's an interesting title. a toxicologist slash nutritionist.
It is. It's an, he was an interesting guy, but he didn't believe in nutritional wisdom. And I told him, and this is more of the Black Bear story, I told him that what we discovered was that when we gave goats choices, most goats, now let's say 80 or 90% of the goats would do this, when we gave them choices between the new growth, which was more nutritious, and the older woody growth, they actually strongly preferred the older woody growth to the new growth. And I remember telling him that, and he said, well, I guess that just goes to show that animals don't have nutritional wisdom. And I didn't believe it at the time, but there was nothing that I could say to him because we didn't have any ways to explain why the goats, one, were eating the old growth in preference to the new growth, and two, we certainly didn't have any scientific evidence for nutritional wisdom of the body back in those days, 30, 35 years ago.
So why were they eating the old growth instead of the new growth?
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing to me. It was a little bit, serendipity and really fortuitous, but there was a whole field that was emerging at that time that we were able to contribute a lot to over the years, and it had to do with what people commonly refer to now as secondary chemistry. Primary chemistry would be the nutrients in plants like nitrogen and phosphorus and so forth. Those things that biochemists had studied and come to understand the roles that they played in plants. But there was huge numbers of other compounds that occurred in plants that at that time people really didn't have much understanding what roles they played. In fact, they were considered back in those days to be waste products of plant metabolism. And then later on they adopted the name secondary compounds.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, what we've come to learn in the last 30 years is that these secondary compounds play hugely, hugely important roles in plant health and well-being that we didn't understand in those days. But one of the roles that they play is to prevent plants from being utilized too much by herbivores, to sort of spread the load of use by animals across the community.
Okay, so here I'm gonna taste bad so that all the animals won't eat all of us up, right?
Yes, and that's right. And the more of a particular compound that you put in a plant, the worse you're gonna taste and the worst effect you're gonna have on the body once you get inside the body. And so that field was just in its infancy in those days, and we were fortunate to link up with some people at the University of Alaska who were some ecologists and natural products chemists, and we said, look, we have this really strange thing that's happening. We think that it's probably related to secondary compounds in the plants, and we've done some preliminary work. It looks like it's really high concentrations of tannins that are causing the problem. And so we went to work with those guys, did a bunch of studies from a biochemical standpoint and ran a lot of feeding trials, and were really able to show that it was these very, very high concentrations of condensed tannins that were causing the goats to avoid the current season's twigs. And so the goats knew more than what we knew was the bottom line of it, and they were making the right choices. We just simply didn't understand until we delved into it what their choices were based upon. If we'd simply stuck with the primary compounds, we'd say, well, the goats don't have any wisdom at all. On the other hand, it was that there's way more to it than what we understood.
Way more to it. You talk a little bit about the ranch owner that you worked with when you were a kid and how he talked about how animals get to know the range.
Yes, yes.
What did he mean?
Well, what Henry was talking about there is another area that we've worked in tremendously over the years and still working in. And he was talking about the knowledge that an animal learns from basically its experience of living on a landscape. And more generally, what we've worked on so much is this transgenerational kinds of learning, where offspring learn from their ancestors through their mothers, this local adaptation and just these transgenerational linkages.
Which would constitute the nutritional knowledge that you, of which you speak, right?
Well, there's two parts to it, Michael. There's that part that's really a very important part of animals learning what and what not to eat by following. Well, actually, it starts in the womb. It starts in utero. Flavors of foods that are in mother's diet start to get the young animal familiar with what she's eating, and then flavors in milk once a young animal's born, and then following mother around on landscapes. All that becomes a knowledge of what and what not to eat and where and where not to go, what's a predator, what's not a predator, all the nuts and bolts of the home field advantage and being locally adapted. So that's one important part. This other part, though, that we were talking about, too, on the primary and secondary compounds,
right,
gets into to feedback mechanisms that are really built into animals. It can be confusing here, and I don't want to confuse people, but it's two kinds of learning, two complementary kinds.
Okay, we're going to pick up the feedback loop because I think we can work that through and in an understanding way.
We can, I'm certain. And it's important because it's really kind of... Let's work through that. Let me start with an example.
Hold on, and we'll pick it up when we come back from this quick
okay,
break.
Sounds good, Mike.
Folks, we're talking. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Dr. Fred Provenza from the Department of Wildland Resources, University of Utah. He's way out there in the outback of Colorado, so the phones lines are a little bit scratchy today, but just kind of bear with us because there's some really interesting stuff coming up about food and our animals and our environment. And, hey, we may as well throw ourselves into the loop as well, the feedback loop. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, we will be right back. Well, we're talking about two kinds of knowledge inherent in animals. One kind is the kind that you get from your parents, or animals get from their parents in learning how to adapt to an environment. But the other kind is a feedback loop that we learn from experience. And before we go to that, I'd like to ask Dr. Fred Provenza, from the Department of Wildland Resources at the University of Utah. Do you see any correlation between animals and people with respect to this nutrient knowledge?
I sure do, Michael. It's been hard over the last 30 years not to see so many parallels, really.
Uh-huh. And I just wonder, you know, you look at what we've done to our bodies in the big sense, in the sense of overeating the wrong things and losing track of our bodies, and you think that we'd learn, but evidently we're not doing too well. Let's go to this feedback loop that you've been talking about, that you introduced before the break. We talked about two different kinds of knowledges, you know, that animals get, one from their parents, but the other is from experience, right?
Yes, from the personal experience of eating the food. That's exactly right. You know, what we've come to appreciate over the years is that mother can facilitate the acquisition of behavior by her offspring in the case of feeding, but continuation of the behavior depends really strongly on the consequence to the individual, and that's where these feedback loops become so critical. If you think why any creature, including us, eats a food, what is it that we're feeding? It's ultimately these trillion cells that make up our bodies. And feedback, without bogging us down in the details, has to do with the way all of these cells and organs communicate with the palate. And there's just this incredibly intricate system of nerves, hormones, neurotransmitters that allow those two things to talk to one another. So...
Oh, there we go. I think we just lost that connection again, but we're going to pick it up when we come back. In the interim, we're going to pick up
Retriever.
Another one here as soon as we can, as soon as Carol picks him up. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Dr. Fred Provenza about the nutrient knowledge of what animals, and he's working with some goats. And he's using the goats to prune blackbrush shrubs in the deserts of Utah. And he wants to use these animals to create more food for other animals. And in the process of developing this as a grad student, he makes some incredible discoveries, one of which is the fact that animals have inherent knowledge of nutrient requirements of their own body. And they get this knowledge from two different sources. One, from their parents and how their parents teach them to interact with the environment. And the other is from this feedback loop. And it's in essence, he's saying that that the body learns from experience on how to manage these things. And so that's what we're talking about. As soon as we can figure out how to bring them back from the wilds of southern Colorado, let's try going to another line and see what Bob has to say. Bob, are you there?
Oh. Hello?
Yes, Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, these were questions for Fred.
Well, go ahead and we'll pick them up. And we've got the entire staff here at the radio station working on trying to figure out how to use the phone. So we'll get them in a minute. What do you got questions?
Well, the question is reconciling two types of grazings that are part of the new paradigm that's going on now. One is the free choice salad bar grazing, which works in very well with what Fred was describing.
Yes.
Dr. Fred, excuse mm-hmm. me. And the other is the mob grazing, which is the normal grazing pattern of a herd of animals if they're protecting themselves from predators. And it would seem that if the animals are tightly bunched up in a herd, that they don't have as much choice.
Oh, I think we have Fred back. Fred, are you there?
Yes, yeah.
Good.
Just got back.
Good. We have a great question from Bob. Bob, where did you get these questions? That's a very good one.
Oh, I've got animals out in the field.
So there you go. First of all, he wants to know about the two types of grazing and the efficacy of both. And he talks about salad bar grazing, where animals are free to kind of roam around and eat what they like, right?
Yes.
Yeah, even if that's combined with rotation, just in terms of the amount of space they're given and so on. And the other is mob grazing, which is kind of a hot topic nowadays. But mob grazing seems to me to be much more like the way that animals grazed in herds when there were lots of predators around, that they stayed tightly bunched up. And we're seeing now in our wild meadow, alpine meadows and so on, the elk don't have enough predators to constrain them, and they're going around eating free choice and changing the ecology of it. And my second question, having to do with just grazing ecology, is how this affects areas that have a fire-based ecology.
Ah.
And also, I will offer the conjecture that California, before the megafauna extinctions, had an ecology that was not fire-based. So.
Now, what do you mean by a fire-based ecology?
Well, we have our wildfires in California,
mm-hmm.
and it tends to encourage plants that propagate their seeds better after a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And
let's have Fred pick this up with respect to the sage country that he was talking about.
Yeah, I'm sorry that the question isn't better formulated. Perhaps Fred will know what I'm trying to get at.
Fred?
Well, I'll take a stab, Bob, at some of what you... They're very good points that you're making relative to grazing. The salad bar, let's start back with the salad bar part. And if I'm understanding correctly on that, the point would have to do with the value of animals being able to go around and select, choose what they need. And certainly there's a lot of work that shows how important that is, choice and ability to choose. If we do...
Well, animals are kind of like people, aren't they? I mean, they like to eat a little bit of everything instead of one particular thing.
Oh, they do. They do. They're like... like people exactly. You know, we couldn't stand it if we had to eat the same thing for breakfast that we do for lunch and for dinner and had to do that day after day. So variety, it's just impossible to overstate and think, in my view, how important variety and choice is for animals, whether they're in confinement, on pasture, or on feedlot. So that variety is very, very important. I know we could spend a whole hour just on that.
Sure.
But so the variety part is critical. The ideas of mob grazing and animals in herds and predators is certainly, I think we've come to appreciate more and more over the years, and several people have really emphasized this over the years, how important animals in herds were.
Buffaloes.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and we've gotten very involved in looking at how, you know, in social species, which all the domestic animals are and many, many of the wild animals are so social, those are actually extended families that are out there, and you can get amazing kind of interactions.
Okay, I have to take a quick break. Bob, can you hang on for a second?
Sure.
Yeah, okay, we'll be right back, folks. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Animals, nutrients, food, the environment, and you and I, right back. Oh, we're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Dr. Fred Provenza, wildlife resource specialist, University of Utah. We're also picked up Bob, who has some great questions with respect to grazing. Bob, I want to ask you before we go back to the doctor, in your work with animals and grazing, do you see any parallels with animal nutrition and human nutrition?
Just the balancing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting a farm here. We're 9 or 10 years into doing it, and I remember planting luscious pasture, and we had one milk cow at the time, and she just turned up her nose at the freshly planted pasture and went after the weeds. And so I learned from that is that we're. Our pastures now are going to have 100 varieties of weeds
in
with everything else.
Doctor, how do you describe that phenomenon?
Well, it's what we were talking about just a second ago, Michael. This choice and ability to choose is so important, and it ties back with both primary and secondary compounds in plants.
Mm-hmm.
The secondary compounds, as we were mentioning, set limits on how much of any one particular food an animal can eat. And so if they have a variety of foods with a variety of these different secondary compounds, that allows them to meet their needs for primary compounds, but also to reap some benefits that we're starting to learn about that these secondary compounds in small dosages apparently have for animals. So again, it comes back to this idea that what we'd consider to be weeds, as you're saying, Bob, probably have tremendous variety of different biochemicals in them that the body can utilize. And so having, like you say, 100 of them out there for animals to pick and choose from is kind of the natural way that animals are able to meet all of their needs, not only for the primary compounds, but for the health benefits of some of these secondary compounds as well.
Yeah. And they're deeper rooted plants in general, and I think they're bringing up more minerals.
Yep. Exactly. That having a variety of plants with a variety of rooting depths and different developmental stages are just, that's very, very important.
Thank you for the call, Bob.
Thank you, Michael.
You bet. Let's go quickly to Leslie, who has a similar question with respect to goats and oak leaves. Leslie, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hi, thank you. I have a new goat herd, and we allow them to free forage. And I was told over and again, and everything I read said that oak was toxic to goats, and be careful because they really like it and they go for it. And they do go for it. And I haven't noticed any ill effects when I allow them to eat some of it. But why would they go for something that's bad for them?
Good question. Doctor?
Typically, animals don't do that. There's some ways, though, that the body can be fooled.
Oh, boy, we're going to the feedback loop now.
Yeah,
aren't we?
The feedback loop is...
Thank you for the call, Leslie.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
It's a little bit of a complicated
Well, we can make it really simple, though.
Yes, and I'll try to. Probably one of the best ways from the feedback loop that I could explain that animals get fooled is if the immediate consequences of eating the food are really positive and the negative effects are delayed by a matter of days or weeks or months, that really can be a problem for animals.
Kind of like smoking cigarettes,
exactly.
Or using credit cards or snorting cocaine.
That's exactly it. That's one of the common ways. There's several other ways that a person can start to talk and think about that. But you know, typically with goats, they won't have as much problem with oak is very high in tannin, and tannin toxicosis can cause problems with animals. But if they have a variety of things to choose from, and if they can gradually come on to plants like oak brush, typically it won't be a problem.
As long as they have other things
can mix in with that. Mm-hmm. Yep, that they can mix with that.
Tell us about the
another. Let me jump one other thing that goes back to the other kind of learning. If an animal has no knowledge of a particular plant and they're thrown into a novel environment, a place they've never been before, that can also be a recipe for disaster. Just a quick throw in there, Michael.
Sure, because they don't know what to try, so they have to try.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's another one that can set them up, set animals up for some real problems.
Talk about loco weed.
Local weed's a good example of what we were talking about, or what I was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We work quite a lot with people from the Poisonous Plants Research Lab here in Logan, and they make the point that typically domestic animals don't have problems with poisoning unless we set them up for that. And local weed's a good example of that. It's one of the first plants to green up in the spring of the year. And it's a very, very nutritious plant. But the adverse effects that alkaloids, these secondary compounds called alkaloids in local weed, cause are delayed by weeks or months. And they cause degenerative problems within the central nervous system. And so you have immediate positive feedback from all the nutrients that are in local weed. There's not much alternatives out there. And so it's a management problem as opposed to anything else, really.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to conclude with the biggest question of all, which is, can the inherent nutrient wisdom of animals be used to better manage the environment? And you have some great stories in that regard. Dr. Fred Provenza with the Wildlife Resources University of Utah. We will be right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Today we're talking about the inherent knowledge that animals have of the nutrient requirements of their bodies. And hey, do we have any of those knowledges too? Right back. Animals do have an inherent knowledge of the nutrient requirements of their body. And so can that knowledge be used to manage our environment in more efficient ways? What about it, Dr. Fred Provenza? You've been doing some significant work in that regard, rejuvenating the sagebrush steppes of the American West. Can we use animals and their inherent knowledge of the nutrient requirements of their bodies to manage our environment a little bit more efficiently than we have been in the past?
I think absolutely, Michael. We can, and as you mentioned, we have tremendous number of projects going on, as do other people, with using animals to rejuvenate landscapes, not only for their well-being, but for the well-being of different kinds of wildlife species. I think it's a great option to consider, especially given a lot of the things that are happening nowadays with increase in fossil fuel prices, which
right.
makes some of the traditional ways that we've done things with machinery become more and more cost prohibitive. A lot of people aren't interested in applying herbicides nowadays. And so thinking about animals and then understanding what it takes for them to get the job done by understanding better the nutritional wisdom of their bodies is certainly... It's certainly a wonderful option nowadays. Going back to a point that Bob, I think, was alluding to earlier, really fire and large herbivores in play with predators had major influences on the vegetation that occurs on landscapes. And so getting the large herbivores as well as fire back into those systems in a way to try to rejuvenate those systems, I think, is a wonderful option nowadays.
There you go. So perhaps we can. We're going to go quickly to a couple questions. One from Dr. John Fagan, who's a chief science officer from Global ID Group in Fairfield, Iowa. He asked about the relationship between the amount of spongiform encephalopathy we're seeing in the cervid population, the deer and elk, and the feeding of those animals in the winters with commercial cattle feed. Is there a relationship there?
You know, I don't know from a science standpoint if there is or isn't, but I'm certainly a person that believes that diet, in terms of not only the primary compounds, but what we're beginning to learn about the secondary mm-hmm. compounds and some of the benefits that they can have in appropriate doses, that that's really important. And I think when we simplify diets of animals, that's probably not the best way to proceed.
Okay, quickly, we're going to go to Debbie, and Debbie's cattle are eating sour cherries. Are you there, Debbie?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, hon.
We have been raising cattle for about 40 years, and we have been able to teach our cattle to eat and control certain plants that other farmers would consider to be weeds, but we have trouble with them eating things like wild cherry, which when it wilts produces a cyanide compound, and also purple mint, which is toxic. I was wondering how you can, if there is a way of...
How do you stop them, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good doctor, is there a way?
Even if they have good pasture, they will eat wild cherry. It seems to appeal to them a lot.
Doctor? Are you the doctor? I guess he's not. We guess we lost him. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. We've been talking with Dr. Fred Provenza from the University of Utah today. I see the problem right here. I guess we won't have time to answer that question, but you can always talk with Fred and his people by going to www.behave.net, and you can reach them there. And thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating and What Radio. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.